Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Ball Factory, a Japanese eatery and coffee shop at 95 Montrose Avenue in East Williamsburg. Learn more at brooklynballfactory.com.
Good morning. It's Thursday, May 12th. I'm Emily Pearson, and this is the Main Course OG. I am here with my lovely co-host, Patrick Martins.
Thanks for having me, Emily.
You are always welcome. Just keep the talking to a minimum today, Patrick. Thank you.
Sorry if I talk too much.
Yeah, Anyway, today we have two of our favorite New York chefs here in the studio with us. We have Tim Caspere and John Tillis of Pasquale Jones, Nolita's super, super popular, one of our favorite wood-fired pizza places. You know. Don't tell Roberta's. And Neo New York style pizzeria, which I need to ask you about later because I don't quite know what Neo New York is. Good morning, chefs.
That's a media term.
Yes. All right. Tell me, what is Neo New York?
I think the vibe is basically it's a drier Neapolitan, effectively.
Oh, so it's neo like Neapolitan.
It's like I
thought it was like New New York.
Well, I mean, the format is a 13-inch. Neapolitan, you know, 260 gram pizza.
So. Foldable.
Foldable.
And does the mozzarella move around like
when it comes out of the oven, yes, but you can pick it up and eat it.
It's not knife and fork.
No droop on the tip?
No droop. That's the best case scenario, that's how it comes out of the oven. That's what we're going for. Because, I mean, we went to Napoli. We ate at, you know, five or six of the pizzeria there. And we, like, didn't really think that that spoke to New Yorkers or us, that for that matter, you know.
Right,
like most New Yorkers like to pick up their pizza and eat it.
Mm-hmm. That's how probably I would say, 95% of all pizzas eaten in New York are...
I only do knife and fork if it's like just too mushy to pick up because
there's too much
mozzarella, too much weight, whatever it might be. So Pasquale Jones has it right. So we always open the show with a game of word association. This week we have two words for both of you. Feeling especially appropriate with the St. Patrick's Day parade being postponed, not canceled. Respond to whichever one speaks to you. We have Irish pubs and corned beef.
Is this a one-word answer?
You know, a few...
A half a word, if
short
possible.
Sentence.
No, you can do a paragraph.
Farrell's Bar and Grill. For those of you who know it, in Windsor Terrace is the premier Irish pub.
That is Chef John Tillis.
What would make you say such an outrageous thing?
It's been open since... I think I read this morning, 1933, and it's just been a staple of the neighborhood I grew up in for, you know, obviously as long as I can remember, but most of the people that, you know, have lived there can remember.
Will you be celebrating St. Patrick's Day there?
Probably not.
Okay. Tim?
I'm descended from Irish and Scottish folks. I'm a dumb Irish kid from Jersey, and I'm gonna go high here and say that pubs are not like they are in Ireland, in New York.
We were just asking.
How is that going high? You're saying they're
just like the I'm just being a snob. It's like pubs are not the same in New York. You call it an Irish pub. Like, go to Ireland, go to an Irish pub in Ireland. It's a totally different thing.
What are some of the key differences?
There's dogs running around. Mm-hmm. You can go there for your tea in the morning. It's a communal place. You know, it's not like this.
It's not only nighttime drinking.
Sort of a exactly. So,
do you have somebody's with their computers just working there for 3 hours? No, not so much, right? At the Irish pubs, it's
not
more people coming through.
It's a community-based kind of thing. It's more like the cafe.
It feels like
the cafe is to Italy.
The
pub is to Ireland. Yeah,
yeah. They go 3-4 times a day. The workers.
What about corned beef? Nobody.
Corned beef, man.
No one's hot on corned beef.
Mm. maybe in a sandwich.
We did a limited edition corned beef.
With Wagyu, and it was one of the most exquisite things.
So we did it for heritagefoods.com, and it sold out like 60, 70 pieces within, I don't know, 2 hours. So we don't know if it's because it was a little more unique, high-quality beef or just...
More people ordering direct delivery to your door.
Yes.
Is that a service you provide?
Well, mail order, yes. Not to
well, if you're listening to this podcast on a year's delay, today is March 12, 2020. We are in the midst of the coronavirus. Upgraded to the word pandemic, I believe, as of today. So our first topic in our round robin weekly base section that we do, we have to discuss the elephant in the room, the coronavirus, COVID-19. What does it mean, you guys, for the restaurant industry, for all of us right now?
I think it's scary. It's very, very scary. You know, we haven't seen the worst of it, I don't believe, and I think restaurants really have to figure out how to hunker down and endure through a period of time where you may or may not have a lot of foot traffic and your revenue is going to go down. You have to, you know, if you have a responsibility to your workers, like think about cutting your staff. I mean, it's scary.
Yeah, I mean, we need to take care of our employees, but also take care of the business, and you have to find a balance. And right now we're sort of still trying to find that balance and what that looks like, and obviously there's developments every day, so... We're sort of in the wait and see phase, and I imagine in the next couple of days it's going to become more clear what our sort of path will be.
Is the general vibe from your workforce that they want to come in and get paid, or that it's your responsibility to pay them even if they're not working, or that they don't want to come in and just let it ride?
I think right now people are nervous, so they're not thinking so much about not getting paid because they haven't been out of work yet. People don't – that comes later, I think. But right now I think people are, you know – are feeling anxious.
Concerned for their own physical health.
I think we're all at the top of this sort of, you know, we don't know what the ripple effects are all going to be. We're sort of at this, the top of the peer, you know, the dominoes haven't started to quite fall yet. We're just sort of anticipating it. But I guess, so with that in mind, you know, I asked everybody, Patrick and I have been talking about it a lot. How can we all support local businesses while also being precautionary and considerate, you know, of ourselves and our colleagues? You know, I know personally, I was saying to Patrick, I went out to dinner last night. It's sort of at the forefront of my mind that I want to still go out to restaurants.
You did last night.
I know I did. I went out to eat last night. I wanted to make sure that I wasn't just ordering in or cooking at home. I wanted to support businesses that, as we're discussing, you know, need guests.
Were you in any way, shape, or form concerned? Like, not in the least, right?
No, I will say I washed my hands more than I ever have in my life at a restaurant.
Yeah, and you have brought the Purell around. I get it.
Yeah, and I joked with it was a restaurant in Greenpoint, and I joked with the hostess server. They sat, we were at a communal table, but they left an empty seat in between each group.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, is this the new like coronavirus method? She's like, no, it's our weeknight. You know, we're not usually packed to the gills method. But by the time I left at 8:30, they were seating people next to each other because they actually were very crowded. I think neighborhood restaurants, I hope you guys feel this, like Nolita, Pasquale Jones, I hope that the neighborhood is home and supporting you guys.
I mean, I think in sort of these crisis kind of times, I mean, people still like to go drink and eat comforting food. Maybe more than ever, you know what I mean? So I think some restaurants will have the capacity to endure because... You know, people just want to go out and still feel like comforted in some way.
Yeah. And there's a sense of community, and you know, we're definitely benefiting from that community.
Yeah, it's not a curfew; it's more like a self quarantine. But how would you navigate the worker politic? Because I mean, you as the top guys, I have a sense that even if many of your workers were like, we can't come in, you guys might be like, well, we're still going to come in. We could make it work on a mass unit level. So you have to be respectful, but also you yourselves. Like I was thinking about the newscasters. They still go in and do the work. They're not like, we are here in my living room telling you the news. They go in.
Yeah. I took the subway to work the other day, and like one person on the train coughed. Uh-huh. Everyone else turned around like, how could you, you know?
So how do you navigate it, Chef? I mean, you're going to have to make possibly some tough decisions.
Yeah. I think we're looking at the possibility of, you know, like, I mean, if you look at what happened in Italy, so you've got the closure of like many, many businesses. A lot of restaurants are moving to this system of like having this, you know, restaurant at your house or like this place, Santo Palato, this restaurant, I love in Testaccio. This girl, Sarah, she's closed her restaurant, and she has a program. You have to, like, WhatsApp her or whatever, and you place an order, and they deliver to your house. Mm-hmm. So you still support that business, but you don't have to be exposed.
Clearly,
to the
that
public.
Means that that Italy doesn't really have a caviar and Grubhub and all these businesses where you go on. It seems that Italy is a little bit more like, "Hey, you can. Here's my cell phone number. Message me privately. We
just,
will
call
still
me later. You know, we'll see if I, you know."
And you get in 2 or 3 days.
It might be cold. No, I think that do you delivery?
We deliver through Caviar.
Okay, and are you finding that are more people?
It definitely seems like sales are picking up because people are staying home but still trying to eat Pasquale Jones food.
That's great. Well, I mean, it is. I mean, I was listening to the classical music station today, and he said something like, keep normal, stay clean, which is right. And, you know, I have to say I'm a little annoyed at the NBA for canceling. I feel like, I don't know. I mean, I'm not a medical guy, and I know you're supposed to keep everyone quarantined so the thing doesn't get out of control and, like, overwhelm the hospitals. But I also think, like, most people get it and nothing happens. They don't even have to go to the doctor. Well, so this is, like,
it's
old
dangerous
people,
to say
I
that,
get.
Though. It's dangerous to say that, oh, it's just the flu.
But for old
because maybe
people,
you don't get sick. But
and nobody wants to be liable.
Give it to someone else.
Well, yeah. I think that's the big thing. It's liability. But yeah. I have a question.
I'm speaking selfishly a little bit, but my gut has always been, you keep going.
Would you prefer them to play without fans? Because I
know
that
basketball
was...
Basketball fans? Yeah.
They were talking
so
about
TV, well, they're doing that for March Madness. March Madness is still happening, but they are playing all the games without spectators.
Right.
So, I mean, economically, the sales of T-shirts and hotel rooms and flights and everybody traveling to all the games is severely in the toilet. I mean, maybe the gambling industry will do well because people are still going to bet from home and TV ratings will be good.
It's
going to
change the odds.
Go out at your own risk. I don't know. I just really hope people still go out to restaurants. And I think also this is being used, the coronavirus, a little bit as an attack on the hatred towards Trump by a lot of the news media. I hate him too. But, you know, I think they're like, look at what a terrible job he has. Millions of people are going to die, you know. And then meanwhile, the Republicans, I watched Fox for a bit, and they're like, Trump saved a million people from dying. So everyone is like talking about millions of people of dying, one to attack and one. And I'm just like, you're going to a restaurant. I'm going to a restaurant. You know, I know pregnant people going out because they're like... So I don't know. I keep thinking of Al Roker, and I know you keep hating this. I saw him at the Halloween Day Parade for Thanksgiving wearing a helmet. And I'm like, this has gone too far. This has gone too far.
But I think in contrast, a lot of the population in northern Italy is older.
Yeah.
Right.
Right? It's more of a trend that the younger generation leaves, and the older generations are left there. You know,
it also sounds like
homes.
Here in the U.S., I think the schools that are closing are not necessarily because a young student was infected. It's that there's like a parent or a grandparent or a guardian who had a contact with someone with coronavirus, and the school is being protective. So, you know, you have to look at who caregivers are and what everybody's family life looks like. And I don't know. You know, I think precautions you do what you're comfortable with, but we do hope that everybody will... Sort of, you know.
I mean, I imagine the city will sort of tell us what to do sooner than later. That's my sort of prediction.
Because people go and you'll see what the other restaurants are doing. It'll be a communal.
Right. And you know, if a large restaurant group decides to close all its restaurants, people are probably going to follow suit. And if, you know, de Blasio says, please stay home, people are going to do that. That hasn't happened yet.
He did say, go out to restaurants, please, didn't he? And Eater, there was an article.
That one I did not see.
Yeah, de Blasio was arguing or recommending that people continue to go out, you know, but at the same time.
I mean, there's even another business sort of associated with our group. It's Parcel. It's a wine delivery service.
Oh, is that what you were talking
you
about
don't
even before?
You have to leave your house to get fancy wine.
That was different.
Yeah.
Okay, so how does that work?
I mean, it's similar to any of these food apps. You just kind of call this you know, this app up and...
Can I get it by the glass?
They have a van. You have to buy the whole bottle.
I hope my 7-year-old son Max is not listening.
He's got your
credit
card.
He's on the internet.
Yeah, exactly. Like people who children have learned how to use Amazon's Alexa. But so speaking of alcohol, I'd like to talk a little bit about barless restaurants. So Pasquale Jones doesn't actually have a physical bar.
We have a dining counter, actually.
But that's
consider
just
that
the
like
shape of a table.
That's like a pizza counter,
correct.
A pizza bar.
Yeah,
but you obviously you serve wine and beer, no liquor, correct?
No liquor,
no booze.
So is that all just like in low boys underneath in coolers? Do people come in and say, "Do you even have alcohol?" Or do they not?
And also, what's it like not having that source of income and place to hang out pre dinner?
Yeah, you said everyone's going to drink and be comfortable. They certainly can.
Well, 4 years in, people know we don't have a full bar program for the most part. I mean,
there are some people who arrive and they want to have like a cocktail. And they're kind of miffed when they find out we don't have it. But then they're like, oh, I'll also have this really great glass of white wine. It's just like one for the other. I mean, there's some people that are not going to like it, but I mean, it's a wine destination.
And is it a challenge financially to make it work without that, like, without liquor? $32 for two cocktails?
We're not paying a bartender. We don't have a bartender. We don't have all this inventory.
Right.
Everything's kind of consolidated in this small restaurant. 50 seats. We all kind of wear different hats. Some of the servers... our barista, Sam, it's all kind of combined so that, you get around it by saying, hey, we don't need a bartender.
When you sit at the pizza, it's been a long time since I've sat at the pizza counter. Does your chef serve you your wine?
No, but I'm prepared to talk about wine if I need to.
I was going to say, John, can I order my glass of red with you while I order my pizza?
I'd be happy to.
John's right there.
I know. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I said, can he pour me my wine too? But
what I love about Pasquale Jones, it gives you the sense when you're seated there that there is a huge bar because it's packed with people waiting to speak to the maitre d' in the little winter cubicle that you build outside. I mean, you're walking by 20 people, and yet there's nothing for them to do. Very nicely, though, your manager gave us a glass of wine while we waited. I know you do that. So you do feel like you're having fun even while you're waiting.
Yeah, that's funny. The downside is there's nowhere for people to wait.
That's the biggest downside for sure.
Or you have like these single diners that come in. There's nowhere for them to sit and have a something to eat.
Now let's talk about your restaurant group, the opposite, Legacy Records, which is a multi cavernous room, multi floor private bar door scene.
Yeah,
that's the opposite in many ways. Full bar.
Yep.
So Patrick and I went last week. We got a full tour, and it was during the day. But Patrick already had dreams of like being in the secret little private room.
Yeah,
and
we can't talk about that here.
Yeah, there is no
just
private
kidding.
Room.
Sorry. It was I made that up. Are places like Legacy Records, are immune to sort of pandemics and stock market crises because they sort of service this
and the Pasquale Jones?
Absolutely not. Are you kidding? I mean, they do all the PDR.
Oh.
You think all these
so private
all these,
dining, which is
all
really
these groups
taking a hit.
Who are gonna, gonna go out and spend. I mean, they're just canceling.
Yeah, I mean, they benefit a lot from the like Javits Center convention traffic, and so when those things are canceling, obviously they're gonna take a hit. But hopefully the restaurant will still be doing well, and they also have the bars, and so Ada's Place hopefully will.
And
will
they're
be
connected
busy.
To a private residential building, correct?
Yes.
Which I think is pretty cool. They come down and you just like have a. Your coffee shop's right there.
It's not a bad local bar to have.
Yeah.
But Emily, to answer your question, high-end things like Heritage Pork probably suffers less than the commodity world. But in this instance, it's weird because it's truly tourism that's being affected. Sometimes I think we're immune to the ups and downs of the commodity markets or the stock market world because we're vertically integrated and independent of that system. So high-end things are immune, but in this case, the high-end thing is the very thing that will suffer.
Yeah, and I think we've been talking a lot about how the market in Las Vegas and certain areas where there's big conventions and groups that come together, but you forget about that New York and Legacy Records is on 38th Street and the Javits Center fuels it, and as things get canceled, that is a major artery for business.
And I love the idea of what you said earlier, like Pasquale Jones as the pub. As that neighborhood place that during a pandemic even, people can go and eat and get sustained and forget about their fears, but then do you stay open and, all that. So, a lot to think about.
All right. On a more fun and exciting and shiny note, Tim, you were just out in California serving burgers.
To famous people,
burgers?
Maybe?
It was pizza, but...
Patrick told me burgers. Where'd you get that?
I don't know.
All right. You were making pizza for Joseph. I'm not.
Okay. Let's just say we were serving burgers.
All right. I mean, maybe you were making some Italian-inspired burgers. Anyway, that was all to ask you. What do you think of the LA dining scene right now? Like, we always.
And how was that event? It was for the Oscars, I believe.
Yeah, it was an after party. I mean, it was a long night. I mean, we started making pizza.
Not burgers.
At the Chateau Marmont. I mean, for all these guests, up until 7 o'clock in the morning. And even then, they were like, are you out of pizza? I'm like, yes, we're definitely out of pizza.
They're like, but could you put an egg on it and switch it to a breakfast pizza?
Yeah. I had a great time. But the day after, I had dinner at this place, Antico, which the chef, Chad Colby, it's his new spot. It's been open 6 months. It was amazing. It was an amazing meal. And I don't often go out to eat Italian because I work with it so often. And,
right.
But it was exceptional. It was really, really good. But the one thing about LA that's maybe true, that's not so much true in other cities, is they've got this culture of like opening restaurants and strip malls and just these areas which you wouldn't have any idea how special something is based on the location or what kind of building it is, you know?
No, we've talked about that before, and that in LA you maybe have to travel 20, 25 minutes. It's more of like they're destinations, but they're getting fueled by, I don't know, is it infatuation writing about them? Is it word of mouth? Is it social media? But that a restaurant can exist in like a funny little sub neighborhood.
Yeah.
Roberta's is one of those places.
Yeah.
But I mean, Roberta's, could this exist anywhere else?
No, they have LA in the mall, and they were criticized for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, this place.
But it's been quite successful.
Has it, the one in LA? Yeah.
That's what I hear.
And Brandon says it's successful.
I mean, part of like going to restaurants, I think, in New York is you go to that neighborhood and you feel this, there's a vibe.
Yeah, I love LA. It's very New York, I think, even though everything about it is different, like physically. The people are like New York. The energy is New York. Whereas San Francisco, which I love, is not like New York at all.
Well, we always like to talk about ascending and descending cities. You know, LA has very much been on the rise from a culinary perspective. Do you think it still is?
I'm going to defer to Chef John Tillis on this one. He was out in LA recently.
Okay.
I think LA is one of the most compelling food cities. I like a lot of things about it. I mean, particularly that they have sort of mastered the all-day cafe in a way that I think New Yorkers don't really understand. Yeah. People eat. I just feel like, you know, like longer lunches in New York, people grab a salad, go back to the office, eat at their desk. LA has enough of a leisure culture that it can have, you know, cafes that just sort of, you know, exist from 10 to 10 as opposed to New York, which is really sort of like 5 p.m. to midnight. And then the food is obviously exceptional because the, you know, access to amazing produce is all right there.
What is the name of that fabulous long bar, Gelina? Is that the one?
Giusta.
Does bread in-house.
I think we went there 8 times in 3 days.
As many times as possible.
That's out in Venice. Yeah.
That's an example of what you just gave.
Completely. I mean, I have that place in mind when I talk about those types of places. Just
for me, every time I go there, when I'm in LA, I make a point to go to Giusta, but I time it with traffic. So I have to find like a somewhat off time of day to plan to get there.
Because you just take the 5 to the 35 to the 10 to the 4 to the 1 and then go by Santa
Monica,
and then
the, PCH,
then the
yeah.
7 to the 3, and then you'll be there.
Yeah.
That's what I did.
In no time.
Everyone should quote Patrick on that. Don't refer to Google Maps ever. Just use all those highways that we think might be.
What about
LA.
Ascending cities or descending cities? Is New York an ascending food city? Is it staying even or is it descending? Well, most people say descending on this show.
If you contrast, I mean, look at. Okay, so let's take an example. Nomad, right? Nomad with Daniel Hum, Will Gooder.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So that restaurant, they took that to LA. And it wasn't like a huge success.
Yeah. It's interesting.
You know what I mean? I mean, they closed the top floor of that because of the lack of business. But they opened it downtown, but it's kind of like.
Would it have succeeded had they put it in Beverly Hills?
Maybe West Hollywood or Beverly Hills, yeah. It's hard to say, but I mean, downtown is the neighborhood where I think I ran into someone in the elevator who was like, oh, I'm here from out of town. I'm just going to go for a jog. And she like jogged right down the street. And she's like, oh my God, nobody told me that there's like a tent city down here. I got chased back to my hotel.
Oh my God.
You know what I mean? But as far as ascending and descending, I mean, that's an example of like, there is some descent, I think, of that idea. There's something in New York, I think, that's not getting pushed forward in the way that you see it in LA and San Francisco.
Hmm.
I mean, part of that's probably a real estate thing. I mean, there's just, even though I don't think LA is much cheaper than New York, it does feel a little bit freer. You know, New Yorkers are burdened by small spaces, high rent. Restaurants in LA just feel like there's more freedom. Maybe that's to be creative, but also the physical space of the restaurant.
Wasn't there an LA restaurant that was so big that people were speaking different dialects, even though they worked for the same restaurant? It was so big and vast. No, but it's true. It is a huge thing. I mean, they don't have that. And also, that's why they say other cities and other states in the middle of the country are becoming better food scenes, and why New York is having trouble finding talent at some of the restaurants is because these other places that have less baggage.
Well, and everyone's going home. You know, like people come to New York to like to learn because there's all these amazing restaurants that are really essentially schools, and then you go home.
And you guys are both home. You said you're from New Jersey, Tim and yep. John. You're from you grew up in the city.
I grew up in Brooklyn.
So I mean, you guys would have to then say, "I'm going to go start a new somewhere else." But no, we've been hearing and reading. You know, like Minneapolis, Houston is supposedly having a really
Little
big
Rock.
Is Little
Arkansas,
Rock.
Yeah.
But what about Chicago? What's happening in Chicago? Let's talk about that.
Interesting.
I am a rare breed that loves Chicago. I as a
New York, you're part of 270 million people who like Chicago.
No, I hear a lot of people knocking
oh, really?
Chicago. I think a lot of people don't like it as a city. They think that it's like a little fake and sterile and doesn't feel that real. I like
just like Midwesterners in general.
I guess so, maybe. But I don't know. I'm a big fan of Chicago. I think the restaurant groups that do well there, like Let Us Entertain You, Rich Melman, and all their concepts that they continue to open, they're smart. But I mean, there's neighborhoods that are sleepy. There's neighborhoods that, like as you said, there's not even a 5 to midnight. It's like a 5 to 10.
Yeah.
You know, real estate though is like a fraction of the price. It's about a third.
Why do you ask about Chicago?
Well, I just think like I mean, I haven't heard people talking about Alinea in a while. You know what I mean? You've got Lee Wollin out there.
I know, and he came here to New York.
But yeah,
Grant came here.
So you think that the people aren't talking about Alinea because they're not respecting Chicago, or because he's not appreciated the way Hum wasn't appreciated in L.A.?
I think maybe it's a trend towards more casual, more comforting dining.
More casual, more comforting. Well, we've talked about that. When look at the fast casual movement, right? We've talked a lot about this station and people not wanting necessarily the traditional sit down.
Yeah,
molecular gastronomy on top
I think, look, I think if you're a restaurant group and you can do both and you can offer something for everybody, I think that's your ideal scenario. You know, look at, you know, we're friends with everyone at Union Square Cafe and Daily Provisions, the fact that they get to do both and they do them both really well. You know, even like Legacy Records, the building that it's in, that it has a beautiful cafe and they're baking their own bread and they're offering something in the mornings for people on their way to the Javits Center, but then they have something in the evenings on the way back. If you have a space and real estate and a footprint that allows you to do both, you know, whether they're next to each other or somewhere in the group, I that to me is like the really big win.
Chicago, to me, has always been insular. Emily and I put all this effort into opening restaurant accounts in Chicago, and we can't open literally
It's a tough,
not
meat,
one.
A tough meat city. They're
they
very,
just have their way
of
doing things.
That seems surprising.
Another city we cannot get into, for instance, is Portland, Oregon. Also very insular for different reasons. You know,
they're more like local to their local ranchers and
we
knowing
can't sell
your
a pound
farmer.
Of meat to Portland.
Chicago's a little bit more like there's meat mafia and nobody really wants to pay higher prices.
Yeah. We can call 80 restaurants, go visit, hello, and then not sell one pork chop to them. Whereas in New York, when we do that, we might sell open 10% of the accounts or you know, 5% of the accounts.
It's interesting, but I don't know. Is there anywhere that's like really just totally peaked? Like speaking of Portland, do you think they've peaked as a food city?
Because of their population, probably, but they're probably one of the most best food places to eat, best cities to eat out in the country. So they don't need to get better. I think
so
you can
San Francisco,
also,
for that matter.
San Francisco, yeah, they're doing great. They're just at the top, so they're not going up or down.
I'd say Philly's still on the rise. I mean,
it's good.
There's a lot of great restaurants, and it's very cheap.
What about D.C.? Will D.C. ever have a great food scene?
Oof, unclear.
I'm worried about when coronavirus is making the way to D.C.
Anne was like watching the press conference yesterday. She was like, Trump sounds sick.
He always sounds sick, and he looks a little, who knows how pale and sickly he looks under the orange.
Under all the makeup. So,
you know, when Jean-Louis Paladin was the chef in D.C., people didn't know if New York or D.C. would be this premier food city in the country.
Well, it's
it was the
same
still
thing
in question.
With George Perrier, the Beck Finn, you know, in Philadelphia.
Okay.
Like, those were
competing
for these real upper echelon fine dining scenes.
Hmm.
And Star kind of, like, I think, bridges the gap. Like, they go
both ways.
Star
is very successful, man.
I mean, Star is really the, like, anchor in Philly. What do you guys think about that group?
I mean, he's had a ton of success, and people like working for him, from what I understand. So it's hard to knock it, you know? I mean, he's got a lot of different concepts, and there's not a lot to...
Yeah, he's good. You can't have one restaurant.
No, honestly, sorry.
They're
going to
be like,
actually,
take them off the air. Right. They're going to be like, that guy's a douche.
Christopher Lee?
Yes, Christopher Lee. Are you talking about the guy who used to work at Chez Panisse and then who opened Obuco?
No, not Christopher Lee, pardon me. Alex.
Oh, Alex.
Chef at Danielle. Like the original CDC from Danielle. Alex Lee, that's it.
Okay.
Star always hires very well, and I think tries to keep people
like
in the family.
Like director, who I mean, he made a huge impact when he was the chef at Danielle.
Are you a fan of like the sort of, I don't know, the alums of Danielle?
Who has the best alumni tree in the U.S.? Is it
Chez Panisse is pretty good. Danielle's.
What about the River Cafe
or L'Espanasse? You know, great.
That's a hot one. Yep.
You know. He just passed, and then they put out that list of all the great chefs that had worked for him.
That'd be interesting, a family tree restaurant, because that is really amazing when you can churn out chefs that go on to open great restaurants. I mean, Danielle is David Chang, right? Riad and Lee.
Melissa from Del Posto.
Right.
Melissa Rodriguez was there. Mm-hmm.
Chez Panisse probably
and I like
has
watch. I like watching the chefs who... left the French world or kept like, you know, some roots and obviously the skill set and the pet and like the heart, but went to another type of cuisine.
Yeah.
But no,
you can see that in Melissa's food. It's Italian, but it's also French.
French, yeah.
For sure.
Because if it stayed 100% Italian, they could never get 4 stars because 100% Italian is, you know.
What? 100% Italian is never going to be refined enough for 4 stars?
Unless it's the most pristine ingredients, you know, like Chez Panisse style where the farm is, you know, down the block and they buy 100%.
Right, you're right. We have to take a very quick
break.
Wait,
let's do the Jay Wayne. We got to cost about less. Oh, are you saying you want to do that after?
Yeah,
okay.
Do it after
I thought you were cutting that question out.
No, never. We got to talk Last Suppers. So
no connection to coronavirus.
We are going to take a very quick break. We'll be back to talk about Last Suppers.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Ball Factory, a Japanese eatery and coffee shop at 95 Montrose Avenue in East Williamsburg. Brooklyn Ball Factory uses the best ingredients to make Japanese comfort food, like their bento boxes featuring meatballs, grilled veggies, Japanese fried chicken, or pork shabu shabu. Plus, visit Brooklyn Ball Factory's sister restaurants, Momo Sushi Shack, Samurai Papa, Samurai Mama, Bozu, and Kitade Shokudo. Learn more at brooklynballfactory.com.
Hey there, HRN listeners. This is Harry Rosenblum, host of Feast Your Ears. I know that news about COVID-19 and the coronavirus has made a lot of people nervous about getting sick. This collective unease has already had a big impact on our restaurant and food communities, especially in New York's Chinatowns. We hope that now more than ever, our listeners will join us in supporting restaurants and the hospitality industry at large. Many of the restaurants we love are small, independent businesses. That means that even 1 or 2 bad weeks can put them in jeopardy of cutting staff, limiting hours, or even having to close for good. As long as we're still able, we should go out to eat and support our favorite restaurants. I think it's also great to remember that hospitality professionals are really good at hygiene and food safety practices. Long before there were guides all over the news about how to properly wash your hands, they were already experts at hygiene. Guests' health is tantamount to successful hospitality in any restaurant. And even if you don't want to go out, you can still support restaurants by ordering delivery, buying gift cards, and giving them some extra love on social media. What better way to handle a crisis than by supporting those in our own community? If we don't support them now, they might not be there when this crisis is over. Join HRN in supporting restaurants during this time, especially our friends in Chinatowns around the country. Thanks for listening.
Great message.
Yes, those were words
keep
from...
Keep normal. Keep active. Stay clean, but keep normal. I mean, that's my thing. And I know there are a lot of different things and you got to be careful with what you say, but keep living your life, especially if you're healthy. I mean, we could lose tens of thousands of businesses. And it's, I have a feeling it's always the little artisans that get fucked, or the family businesses, or the cheesemonger, or the heritage breed people, or the little neighborhood restaurant. Remember, if you feel uncomfortable, order in. But now more than ever, we have to worry about
what we're buying from your favorite restaurant of that course. You normally dine out with.
And if you don't, send your healthiest person of the house to go pick up the box and bring it back. No, we got to
go. The healthiest person is not supposed to interact with the unhealthy person.
No, I mean, if I see someone eating a Hershey's Kiss, I'm going to, you know, throw hot coffee on them. I want them to be eating fine and raw. This is now more than ever. This is where you show what you believe in.
In case you didn't know who you were listening to, that was Patrick Martins, my co-host here on the Main Course OG. We're broadcasting live from the back of Roberta's here in Bushwick. And we are here in the studio with Tim Casper and John Tillis of Pasquale Jones. We have been talking all things.
It's a great group, by the way. They own Charlie Bird. They own Legacy Records. It's a big restaurant
Parcel.
Group.
And what are they? You have a bar? Easy Vic. What's it called?
So the cafe at the ground floor of Legacy Records is sort of separate. They've kind of named that Easy Victor.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a bar on the second floor of Legacy called Ada's Place.
Oh.
Yeah.
And it's an absolutely beautiful place. You feel like $1 million when you walk in there. You just do. Even if all you're doing is getting a croissant and a sandwich, you feel like high ceilings. Is it Art Deco? I don't know. It's very sharp. It's a great place, like for someone's 50th birthday, 75th birthday.
Just like
it's
a like Friday
you feel
night
like Jay-Z.
Feel,
you really
shiny
do.
And special. So last week we had Jay Rayner. He's the restaurant critic from the UK's Observer. He was on the show with me and Patrick, and we asked him about measuring a great restaurant and how many times he visits before reviewing. As it turns out, he and his colleagues at the London Papers actually really only visit each restaurant about once before reviewing. So personally, as chefs, what do you think of this style? And do you think a one and done is unfair?
I mean, if he's talking about great restaurants, I think it's fair.
I think it's fair.
I mean, you got to think that as an operator of a restaurant, you've got one chance, right? You only get one opportunity to, I mean, you never know who's going to walk into your restaurant. That's partly why, like, I try and get these great products. It's partly why we take chances and get, like, a whole veal carcass. Because, you know what, it's like some people will come in and they say, hey, you know, what do you guys have that's off the menu? You got something special? And sometimes we do because of that. So it's kind of like that motivates me to want to work with you guys at Heritage and get these really great pork in house because, you know, that moment someone comes in, we have this thing that's not on the menu yet. It's like it's a great conversation. It's a great moment. And that's that one shot that you have to impress somebody like a food critic.
Mm-hmm. That was well. We're going to also talk about that before the end of the show. But I mean, so one and done. I mean, do you want one shot or do you want a guy coming three times and ordering 24 things? And you know,
I mean, I think in a perfect world, it shouldn't matter because great restaurants are consistent, and consistency is sort of what makes a really great restaurant. And that was sort of like what you really want to drive home to your staff, which is like, you know, whether it's the first diner or the last diner in the night and you're really tired and it's been crazy, or it's the middle of a push, consistency is what makes restaurants really great. Obviously, you want to make sure you have your best showing, so you maybe want more than one chance. But I think ultimately, you know, if you're shooting to be, you know, a truly great restaurant, you should only need one. Obviously, it doesn't always work out that way, but
I think that's a great answer.
Consistency. Yeah, it's very great
answer. I mean, so many things are not in their control. So, yeah, of course.
By the
way,
Jay gave a very interesting thing. The reason they're one and done there is because the restaurant critic there is a great writer trying to be funny, trying to be a little outrageous, trying to be witty, trying to be insightful, whereas the food reviewer in the United States, it's more like he's more like a civic servant, an advocate for his city and for his town. So it's not like he called one restaurant. He said going there was like getting an
unlubricated
colonoscopy. Pete Wells wouldn't write that, you know.
His editor probably wouldn't let him.
Brutal.
Yeah. So anyway, it's brutal, but it's funny. And so anyway, journalists come from a different.
They also don't
here.
Have this, you know. Obviously, I'm sure at this point, you guys being in the New York restaurant scene, you know what Pete Wells looks like, and you know what the reviewers look like. But in the UK, they're not masked, if you will. They're not a hidden face.
You don't. Yeah. They don't need their picture like on the inside of the coat check.
We did ask.
I did notice. I mean, when Pete Wells came to our restaurant, he ordered the things that were a little bit not like down the fairway type dishes.
So now your standard dishes.
And that's the kind of thing where like maybe you have a dish you sell a couple a night And maybe, as an operator, you're not paying attention to that mise en place because you only sell one or two. Or the cooks are like, hey, you know, we don't really sell it, so I'm going to gamble on this mise en place. Okay. All of a sudden, the food critic comes in and orders it. Then it's a scramble. Be like, oh crap, he ordered the the pig's head croquette. You know, when's the last time I tasted that?
It is interesting. Yeah. I always look at menus. I'm like, what's their go-to dishes, like the veal par, you know, things that you always see, and then what's a little bit off. I mean, I always try to order from both sides of the menu because it's unfair to go all the way. And also, sometimes chefs will be like, can I do the tasting menu for you? And I'm like, no, I came for your famous pasta.
I came for, or I came for the thing that I'm craving. I came for wanting to feel like I'm having a comfortable, delicious meal.
So that's why I'll order one thing that I want and then say, and then whatever the rest. But I definitely want.
It's like this, whatever the other schmucks at the table want to order. So Jay also talked about Last Suppers.
Which he had an article.
There was an article in yesterday's New York Times about famous death row Last Suppers. And he told us that he personally wouldn't have much of an appetite if he was actually on death row. But in a dream world.
And tell him what the guy said before from Charleston, from Hominy, Robert Stelling.
What did Robert tell us?
He wouldn't want to eat a lot because then the guy at the morgue day would be like, this guy is disgusting.
But I mean, isn't the move to order like a huge meal so you get like, you buy another 10 minutes of life? Like, I want this impossible thing that no one can find. Mm-hmm. And
like
I want two ribeyes, French fries, jelly, mm-hmm. some Cheetos.
Sure. Is that your last meal,
No,
Chef?
No, of course
Cheetos
not.
And ribeye.
No, it's not.
So what is your last meal? What would be an ingredient?
Maybe not on death row, but you know
what it is? It's like really closely tied to like a moment. Not necessarily a food, but it was like everything about that moment. I was in Vernazza, which is in the Cinque Terre in Liguria. It was afternoon with my wife. We just got married, and it was like this dish. It was called Vernazza, acciughe alla Vernazza. So it's this anchovies dish, fresh anchovy. Sort of like a layered kind of pave type situation. So it was like these really yellow, rich, waxy, nutty potatoes. A whole layer of fresh anchovies and like crushed tomato and like marjoram or something like that. And like a really cold glass of pigato, and we're like on the water. It was just like, it was so good.
So it's the full setting. Good. It's the full package.
That's what
it's
I want.
It's the memory.
I want
that moment. It's the taste. It's the air.
Now, of course, when this gets tagged on the radio show, it's going to say Tim Anchovies. Yeah.
That's truly his dream, though.
John, what about you?
But it's so much more, you know.
Yeah,
so
no,
that's what's funny.
And actually, we've asked this question of a number of guests, and as recently as last week with Jay, he said it has a lot to do with memories and taste memories. And it's
mine is all gluttonous.
Patrick's is not
no memory.
Memory and
carne cruda, Peking duck, bagel with cream cheese and scallions, and tons of onions and capers, and a lot of lemon on it. Wild salmon. I'm going for no memory. Just pure gluttony.
I have to follow his honeymoon memory.
Okay.
This is ridiculous. I don't know. It's between like a perfect Russ and Daughters breakfast.
Ah, I suppose a bagel?
Yeah, I'm with you. Or like a really perfect New York, like General Tso's chicken with pork fried rice.
Oh. Yeah, like, I was going to say a really perfect New York slice of pizza and the Russ and Daughters.
That's
but now
compelling.
You got me with the General Tso's.
I don't know. Just like, you know, if we're talking about memory, like, that like so much of my childhood.
Let me guess, Sunday night delivery.
God, you know
there was a very funny onion that I get on the Instagram, and it said, "Boy from Portland, only to eat within 5 miles of home, plus General Tso's chicken." What about you, Ems?
No, I'm somewhere in the nostalgia mixed with, I guess, just favorite delicious thing. So I'm a New York slice of pizza,
nice.
But also
cheese.
Well, always cheese.
With
yes.
like with all the garlic powder and all the stuff that's there.
Oregano,
like,
no. chili flakes.
Oregano, just all of it.
No, I'm only...
I need some more of this Kraft Parmesan, please.
Only red pepper flakes. Only pepperoncino. No, none of the other stuff.
I always screw the top off.
Yeah?
And then you end up with one
clump? Oh.
Well, no, I screw the top off because they don't usually fit through the holes. So you're shaking it like for 10 minutes.
I never understand that.
I use it as an arm workout. So, you know, my arm jiggles a little and I just keep shaking.
I'm the guy, I stick my fingers in there and sprinkle it like a chef on my pizza.
Fantastic.
Spreading coronavirus.
Well, by the way, speaking of not being fearful of spreading coronavirus, just Tim, John, and I, we have our shirts off because we are not scared about touching each other in this time.
Yes,
so
I wish you could also keep normal,
stay clean. That's a joke. We're not. But I do want to ask you guys, in a show of real love and appreciation, a kind of gushing, admiring question, how do you guys do it? You buy all our shanks, you know, because we needed it once. You buy the pigs, whole nose to tail. You said yes to the veal. You say yes to goats for Goat-tober. I mean, it is awesome that you guys care so much about sustainability. How do you guys make it work? And what is it about you guys that are driven by spending an exorbitant amount of money on a fucking veal and trying to make it work and driving it to the various restaurants? You take on a lot. What turns you on? What drives you? I mean, people should learn from you guys. We love working with you guys.
I mean, we obviously love working with you too. I mean, that's sort of a complicated question. I mean, the part of it is it's our commitment to sustainability and amazing product, which is very real, but also some of it is, you know, it's an amazing teaching tool. That's how we attract people to the restaurant, is saying, you know, these are things you're not only going to get to work with, but also you're going to have to learn how to butcher a pig or, you know, butcher a veal. And that's really compelling. I mean, cooks want to learn that type of thing. And we don't have, you know, a butcher. You know, it's you know, Tim, myself, Renee, and like, you know, we do a lot of that butchery work. And we're obviously happy to help, you know, involve the cooks in that. And I think that's partly what drives it. And then there's also this sort of way that really Tim and myself write the menu, which is like, we're going to bring in this really special product. And then we're going to let that inform the rest of the menu. You know, we're going to say, let's get this veal. And then we'll decide where it's going to go on the menu. And we let that sort of tension of having this beautiful product really inform the directions we then go in, I think.
How often are specials on the menu? Every night?
Every day.
And you, chef, you're just like, yeah, I want to say yes to this, to those guys. I mean,
it's funny.
We're not dying for that cup, but we're going to fucking make it work. It helps them, and we're going to make it delicious, and we're going
to
get all
and
the
I
guys
And I really
on board.
Need Patrick to stop asking me.
No, yeah, no, I'm going really to get Charlie drives the menu. To help.
And it really does drive the menu. It's part of this process I learned basically working in California with Mike Tusk, where you get the best you can find. You know, and often the best you can find, you got to buy the whole animal. You know, so plus I really don't like using wet aged meat. It has a whole different kind of vibe to it. It cooks differently. It ages differently in the walk-in.
Hmm.
I mean, it's funny. John and I work together pretty closely. So, I mean, he said exactly kind of my perspective is it really drives the menu. It helps us decide how to use that animal, how to use all of it. I mean, if you look in the walk-in, sometimes it's like Noah's Ark. It's like there's a bunch of pancetta, there's some quail, there's a whole veal carcass.
Just anxiety.
Yeah, oh yeah, I know. It's a ton of
tension. Or then, creativity and
but
excitement.
But then sometimes you have, I mean, it's dangerous because sometimes you're like, oh, we got a lot of meat in here. I mean, what are we going to do? You know, I'm getting nervous. Chef, well, I'm getting nervous, but it really drives the menu. And it when you have these moments where you have something that makes an impact, then people really understand. I think it really makes a connection.
For and a lot of our guests, I mean, Patrick, you met one of them the other day at Pasquale Jones, who has a standing reservation and is excited to eat different parts of the pig when he comes in. I mean, he is a great guest and he's really open to trying it. But people now know that there's stuff down there and maybe it's not on the menu. And they're saying, hey, what do you have in sort of the protein department that I'm not seeing right now on the menu? And
that's we really texted cool. each other about the breed. I mean, that was an unbelievable guy. It was a credit to you and the way you guys run your place and the charisma with which you guys are standing right at the bar there, people watching you work. It's not one of those silent kitchens. It's a kitchen. It's going. There's a pizza oven. And there's tons of people and wine. It is a fun place to eat out. We felt like $1 million. Cesare had a great meal. By the way, Cesare also said that one of his three greatest meals of all time was a recent dinner at Michael Tusk's Quince.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Quince, right?
Not Catonia. Yeah, I believe so.
Well, you know, I look back at our history, and I think Anne Saxel, we could say the same thing. We look at these just amazing chefs that literally, with no precedent or no reason, every reason to say no, helped us. And Mark Ladner was one, Carmen Quagliata was one, Sam Edwards, the great cure master, the folks of Fatted Calf. And I really put you guys in that echelon, you know, keep us going, who say yes to try to figure stuff out, sometimes to help us, also saying no when it doesn't work, of course. But we just admire you guys. You guys are very unique.
Plus, we've got other restaurants in the company. We can say, hey, we're heavy on pork. Can you guys take a shoulder?
Yeah, your success allows you to do good. I mean, it means everything to groups like us that are fighting to be unique, you know?
You have any secret off-menu items happening tonight? Or you have to go into the walk-in and dream them up now?
What do you got, chef?
Well, we've got this really great quail coming from Vermont.
That is really special.
We don't know we're going to serve it with, but yesterday we served it with this Umbrian sort of grain dish called imbrachata. We're heavy on pig right now.
Yep. We're definitely serving pork tonight, but come on down.
We actually brought in fewer pigs next week. We called a couple of our farmers, and they were like, what? Because they don't live in this world. They probably heard the Trump talk, but they don't know about the subways possibly, all this stuff. So we're like their voice into what's really going on in the restaurant.
The canary in the coal mine.
We got a bunch of stinging nettles, if that's your jam.
Yeah, I forgot about those, yeah.
Those are coming in today.
That sounds very spring. That sounds very spring.
We're doing some menu work now. We're going to do some early spring menu work today.
Fiddleheads?
Not yet.
Not yet.
I never liked those.
Oh, yeah?
Like kind of
too trendy?
Okra and...
Also just a little slimy.
Slimy.
It's like a cross between okra and Herkimer.
When I took that cross-country tour with Carlo Petrini, by the time we got to Virginia, he would say, translate this. And I'm like, what? He's like, if I get another fucking fiddlehead.
We're in the wrong country.
He's such a sweet guy, that guy.
Yeah, yeah. I translate different for him.
He's like, he said he really enjoys this.
Fucking kids that I don't give a fuck. I'm like, Carlo's happy to be here.
And he's like, you said what I wanted you to, right? And you're like,
no, he knows, actually. Yeah.
So. I love that guy. I cooked a lunch for him one day, actually, in California.
Oh, fantastic. It was very sweet.
I told him we had this like pasta with salsiccia calabrese, and he said, oh, paura. Because I'm afraid, because I guess if you're Piemontese, you don't really like spicy food. But he really enjoyed it. Because it was actually this kind of riff on a Spanish, like, clam and chorizo type thing. Mm-hmm. But it was actually really, really flattering. He had a really great meal, and...
He's a movement guy, but he doesn't never forgets that chefs drive the movements that are important to him. And when he did his first Nobel Prize, it was a Soul Food Nobel Prize, the first one awarded was to an old lady who made agnellotti del pling. And he did the math, and apparently she made like 2 million pling over her career. And she got a standing ovation, and she was, with her black stockings rolled down to her knee and all that, and pretty touching.
Yeah,
but he knows who drives the food scene. All of his ideas come to fruition, of course, through buyers' purchases and all that, but it's the chefs. That's who drive it.
Yeah, no, that's something we've always said. It's you guys drive us forward, and we just want to support you in return.
And the farmers. I mean, they drive the whole all the way down. Yeah. We're just the middlemen, but...
Well, thank you guys so much for joining us. We obviously will be in for a meal at Pasquale Jones very soon. Perhaps even tonight. Very soon. This weekend.
We hope you stay open. Obviously, politics play up. I mean, we hope that people continue to go out. We hope we can go out. We just hope not everything changes. Fingers crossed.
I think we're just going to play a little defense now and kind of figure out how to keep sustained.
We're going to serve the neighborhood and the community until it feels like, you know, we no longer should.
Yeah. All right. Awesome.
Thank you for having us.
Chef John, Chef Tim, thanks for being with us. You're always welcome back on the main course. The Main Course OG is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates, to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.